Aussie music is something to be proud of.
Wear it like a badge.
Because it's Australian bands and artists that are the influences of so many other musicians the world over. So at Triple M,
we're proud to be able to showcase the power of the Aussie music scene.
Paying both homage to the greats that have stood the test of time, right alongside the current, the emerging, the future influences.
The ones that will be next to make their mark on the global music scene.
If it's Aussie and it rocks, it's right here. This is Triple M's Homegrown with Matty O.
Yes, right around the country on the Triple M network. That is 49 stations and on the listener app. This is an absolute treat today from Melbourne to the world. And what a story it is. Burst onto the global stage. Jet's success is not only huge for the band, but other Australian bands like mine in the early 2000s. They gave and made us feel like it was possible to break through overseas. Exciting times for music indeed. Starting out playing shows at the mighty Duke of Windsor in Melbourne, Revolver, Evelyn, then to the stages around the world after the release of their debut album, Get Born. Number one in Australia, multiple countries around the world, 5 million sales. Sold out shows, festival headliners, catchy, amazing songs.
You gonna be my girl?
6 ARIA Awards, certified 9 times platinum in Australia, making it one of the top 5 highest-selling Australian rock albums ever. Inductees into the ARIA Hall of Fame, a band we are celebrating and touring right around the country. Here to chat all things music, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome Mark Wilson. Nick Sester from Jet. How are you, lads? Welcome to the show.
We're good. Thank you for that wonderful intro.
You're welcome, man. Hey, how's it feel to be home back in Melbourne and chilling out and getting ready to go on tour? And I'm imagining with some of these shows, some of these places you haven't been in, well, ages,
I don't
right?
I think ever, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of them we've never... I was saying this to a friend the other day that we're really excited about this tour because by virtue of us sort of blowing up all around the world and at the same time in every different country, we were kind of dragged sort of...
Yeah.
To Japan and to Germany and to US and back to the UK and then back to the US. And we'd come to Australia almost like we're an international band in two of the capital cities and then we'd have to go. And not by choice, just by the fact that there was no – we were just so torn.
You had to be everywhere at once.
No, you had to be everywhere at once. So we kind of didn't do the kind of – these big sort of coastal pubs and stuff.
We did do one regional tour, I think.
Yeah, we just did one. And, you know, and all the stuff that we would have done, you know, in the early days, but – It's an exciting and they're such stalwarts in the Australian music scene and they're still going, so it's great.
Yeah.
And we're pumped to, you know, play these big pubs and you know, most of them are on the coast and
yeah,
it's exciting.
Was it like getting back together and playing these songs and kind of revisiting them? Does it remind you of like recording, like
it
when
does.
You're writing the songs?
I mean, obviously, you know, that's the great thing about music is it can be quite triggering and it takes you straight back to a, you know, a moment in your life, you know, where all these songs were written and we were playing them. But also surprised, because it has been quite a while and I was surprised that to remember them all so well.
Yeah, yeah, I show up to rehearsal all with everything done. I've spent a week playing through the songs and Nick shows up, it's like not done thing and still remembers it all. So the brain still works, you know. I also think...
Also because I never really, really knew them that well.
Yeah. You never do remember those lyrics.
Does it feel like yesterday that you guys were in the studio with Dave Sardi in America, kind of all staying in that apartment complex together and going and putting this album together?
It does, you know. It's a bit scary how sort of fast time flies. But interestingly, when we play it live and we look at the crowd and I look out and I'm like, these people must have been like 5 years old when the record came out because... Yeah. When a lot of our crowd is sort of there seems to be still a lot of discovery going on, or it's people that, you know, it was the first record they bought with their own money. You know, that's what people tell me.
Yeah,
and then they now can come to the show because they're, you know, in their sort of mid to late 20s, I guess. You
one
know?
Thing that I always liked about whatever it is that we managed to do together was it right from the beginning. There was always sort of cross generational, which I kind of liked. You know, there was always you know, dads coming with their sons and it's, you know, it's nice that it's nice that you know, whatever we do, it seems to appeal to a wide range of people, which is good.
Yeah. And I suppose having such a big album like that and with streaming, say what you want about it, it is cool that, you know, you do get this younger audience that are kind of discovering you on Spotify if they find a song on a playlist.
They've
got your huge back catalog to go to as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Recording Get Born, how many of the songs had been kind of Were they all written before you got there?
Yeah, like, yeah. How I mean, I remember when I met these guys in 2002, you know, a year before we made the record. Mm. And I'd seen the band play. I'm the only member of the band who's been to a jet gig.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then they saw me play a gig and asked me to join. And Nick gave me a CD. He's like, oh, here, learn some songs off this.
Yeah.
And the CD was just demos they'd made themselves. And
don't remember that.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was a CD. It was like 17 demos. And the songs pretty much remained exactly the same, except for they were recorded and maybe, you know, a couple of things flipped around and some bits shortened or whatever. But the songs were all on every song, I think, except for Get What You Need and Lazy Gun. Mm.
I remember actually the first, that just reminds me of the first, well, you know, obviously going to LA and working with the first big producer ever, you know, and I remember at the time Sadi saying, guys, like, what is it with your band? Like, every song starts in A.
Yeah, I think we've just kept it like that. You never have to guess what key the songs are.
I think we did end up shifting it a little. Like, oh, some of them started in, like, maybe A sharp.
Hey, it's the greatest rock and roll key of all time.
Was it daunting when you guys first got there to, like, be in, like, these iconic kind of studios in LA and just kind of starting, or do you guys kind of get into it?
You know, at that moment in our lives, we had a lot of, we were pretty gung-ho and we had a lot of, you know, pretty cocksure attitude. And
yeah, decent ego on us at that stage. But also, like, we also started in, like, the crappiest rehearsal studio where Dave just booked out to produce a Dave Sati, booked, like, 2 weeks for us to go into this rehearsal studio.
Nice,
and it was,
nice.
Like, the crappiest rehearsal studio. It's probably been knocked down now, but...
Do you remember, you thought you were about to launch into the
Kiss story?
Yeah.
It was the worst rehearsal studio you've ever seen, like, it was falling apart, and we were just in there, because I think he wanted to make us go, like, okay, it's not going to be all, like, Hollywood.
Yeah,
it's going to going to be some work in some grit, you know, and it was just a crummy, stinky rehearsal studio, and then we were in there one day, and then next door we heard this band, and we're like, oh, is that, like, the worst Kiss tribute act door? And it turns out it was Kiss. And they were booked into the crappiest rehearsal studio as well.
Really?
And apparently Gene Simmons still tried to screw them down on a price.
Oh my God.
They were rehearsing their drummer who hadn't played, Peter Criss, I think, who hadn't played with them for years. So I think he didn't want to spend too much money on what was probably not going to be a successful venture.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, it was pretty funny. But it was you know.
But they had a whole process that was explained. Like, they begin always in a pretty crappy place like that because... Yeah. Then they do like the you know, they change to a bigger rehearsal space, where there's a proper stage and and then they have to rehearse, in a proper arena with the pyrotechnics, and there's a whole process,
Of course.
But yeah, anyway, we were in there just to, like, make sure we didn't get ahead of ourselves, and it was just like being in a movie when you look back at it. It's just you and your mates running around LA just being idiots. And
it was the first time we'd all been overseas.
Yeah, I'd never been out of the country before. Cool. Yeah, 21 or whatever.
Unreal.
And we were all living with our parents.
Wasn't. No, I was living up in Melbourne because I'm not from here originally. But I was just living in a flat around the corner from the Duke, which is why I met these guys.
Yeah, sick. Awesome, man.
Yeah.
And how long did it take? It was about a month to get the album down?
I think it was about 6 weeks, because we recorded it, we tracked it for 2 weeks, and then we went off and toured with the Stones in Australia in 2003, and then went to the UK for a week or two, and then came back, and then finished it in another studio. I think that was another, like, four weeks. It seemed like a long time at the time, because we'd never spent that much.
Budgets were a lot bigger back then,
Exactly.
What was it like kind of hearing these songs back in the studio? Like, you guys had pieced demos together, and like you said, you hadn't really kind of played them before, and you're hearing, you know, Are You Gonna Be My Girl? Like,
it was just nice to hear them being recorded at that level, you know, because the songs were already, you know, like Mark said, the songs didn't change that much. We might have shifted some keys around a little.
Yeah, a couple of lyric changes here and there.
Whatever, but the songs, you know, but just to hear them being recorded at that high level was great. You know?
And just sitting in a room where there's like six, like, kick-ass, you know, engineers and assistants and, you know, our producer and all these people who've worked on these incredible records. Like, our guy, one of the guys who was working on it had made, like, a bunch of Public Enemy records and
access to all this gear too.
Yeah.
I mean,
just seeing the care all these people gave for our music, you know, it was just like, cool. It was just us, like, recording on, like, four tracks and, like, whatever little digital things that we could cobble together at the time. And now you've got a whole team of people who give
there's one guy, the drum doctor, who just has like a warehouse of drums from like the 30s until the, you know.
Like, you can get like the snare that, you know, that they used on Nevermind, or, you know, one, you know, like.
That's so cool.
You know, I mean, I think we use that kind of stuff, which is only really possible in a place like LA, I guess, which is built for, you know, built for stuff like this.
Would have been hard to leave.
Yeah. It was cool. And he'd come into like this drum doctor guy would come into the studios, tune the drums up for each song, you know. He'd be like, I reckon we should use this kick drum. You've got this 1920s Slingerland thing. And
he was mates with Charlie Watts, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
holy hell. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And then what was the gap between like the recording finishing and then it actually being released?
That's a good question.
It was, I think we finished recording it in the first few months of the year and then it wasn't released until September, I believe. We pretty much, the day it finished recording, we were packing up our like service department and we were in a van and touring straight away. You know, like there was no coming home. It was just like literally pack your stuff, get in a 15-seater van. And then we didn't stop.
I think that's what, I remember when we caught base first time, we touched on that. I don't think people realize how much extensive traveling you guys did in the Tarago.
Yeah.
But before it all kind
and
of
like
kicked
we
on.
And everyone says, oh, you guys exploded onto the scene. But we played gigs in Detroit where there was more people on stage than there was in the crowd. And then one of the guys in the crowd left to grab a drink and there was no one that left, you know. You know, there was like five people in the venue and one left, so there's like to grab a drink, so there's like, you know, there's only like tiny little crummy venues, but like it was where we cut our teeth. And you know, I think the misconception that it was all handed to us is not true. Like we basically in a van, slept in a van, you know. I remember we broke down at Niagara Falls once for, you know, we broke an axle on our trailer, and we had to, you know, you're doing, you know, it was pretty.
Also the years of preparation before that, like just honing the songwriting craft, and, you know, spending hours and hours together in you know, dingy little rooms.
Yeah.
Making sure the songs were as good as they could possibly be as well. Mm. You know, like.
Yeah, it's definitely back in the early days for us. One of the ethoses we had was more on the songs and, rather than we'll get the songs right, then we'll go and play, rather than like we'll just write a song and play it the next day. You know, it was a bit of a different ethos. So yeah, we'd spend the time on just honing, like Nick said, before like getting out and playing the set. We wanted the set to be as good as it could be before, you know, we actually went out and played it.
It's crazy, isn't it? Like you need to do those hard years in the Tarago, don't you? Because when you get to the stage that you guys were at, like, thank God you had all that under your belt, right?
And also just so you appreciate it when it happens too, you know, keep your egos in check.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So when did things start to change? When did the momentum start
to build? When did the egos take over?
Now, it kicked off in the UK a lot earlier because they had, I mean, back then they had Enemy.
It was the EP out as well.
We had an EP out and the Enemy was championing that pretty early. And before we actually signed any record deals, that EP came out on a local Australian label here. And they got a hold of it. So when we went to the UK in between making the record and doing the Stones tour out here, in between the tracking and the overdubs and stuff for the record, like that, we were playing sold out shows, tiny but sold out shows in Nottingham and I think we played London, Nottingham, and maybe one other place, I can't remember. And they were small venues, probably 200, 300, but they were packed and the energy was ridiculous.
It must have been encouraging going from the UK, playing that, seeing the momentum there, then coming back, you know, not as crazy in the States, but you knew that something was kind of happening.
Yeah.
And then,
in the States, it was like one of those things, you play in New York and LA and people knew you, but everywhere in between, you had to do the work. Yeah, and we always...
Which is good because it could have kept us on our toes too, because, you know, we'd be flipping around so much and some places we were already a bit more established and then we're starting from zero again in other places. So that was also help, you know.
And we used to say healthy. America's like painting the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Like once you finish it, everyone's... it's rusty on the other end, so you've got to go back and start again and paint it again, you know. So, yeah. And then, I mean, but it was like that in every country you went to. We did that all over Europe. We did that in the UK. We did that in Japan. We did it. And then here was always pretty good because we were from here. So we could come back and we had like a fan base.
Where did you prefer touring?
I love touring Europe and Japan. Europe because, especially the festival season, you're in a new country with a new cuisine, speaking another language every second day. It's so fun because you'll zip around. And the other fun thing about what we were doing during the, you'd play like a festival play festivals Friday, Saturday, maybe Sunday, but maybe mainly Friday, Saturday, and then have a couple of days off. And during the week, you jump on a Stones tour and play a couple of shows with the Stones in like Spain or whatever. And then you jump back on the festival circuit because during the week, you got nothing on. So you know, and you're not doing your own shows because you're playing the festivals. So you jump on with the Stones or something and do a couple of shows with them in like Spain or Portugal. And then you jump back go to Austria and Germany But and Japan's just great because it's just, I just love Japan.
I saw some footage from, is it Fuji Rock? You guys playing that? And that just looked nuts.
Yep.
Yeah, that was and always... Japan was like, for us, was that was probably the first place to just go nuts.
Yeah.
When we didn't expect, early days, like I remember playing Fuji Rock.
It was
Rock.
One country where the order of the lineup would often flip, you know, like bands who were much bigger than you in other places all of a sudden were.
Yeah.
Where was your favorite place to tour?
I'd say Europe for sure. Also, just because, you know, in the States, you'd do a show, then you drive all night and wake up and you're still in the States.
Yeah.
But you do that in Europe, you wake up in 2 hours. Well, you don't even need to go to sleep. In 2 hours, you're in Sweden, in another country with another history, another language, another cuisine, all this stuff.
What's it like coming off the back of, like you said, just at the end of doing those kind of small shows in the States and then you're going to different countries? Like you said, that was the first overseas trip you ever done. And you're going and they're singing all the words.
Yeah.
Like, that must be the best feeling.
Yeah.
I think the only way you could tour that long was because of the how fun and how exciting it was, that. Because it was, I remember at the end of that couple of years and just being like,
burnt.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And the other thing was every country was at a different level at the time. Like, you know, it took a while to get everything up to a certain level. So, you know, you'd be kicking ass in the UK and then you'd go to Germany and kick ass and then you'd go to France and France hadn't sort of got there. So you'd play, you'd constantly be doing kind of different levels of show. So you know, it was good in that because you do the small shows and you can see the whites of people's eyes, which is great. But then the big shows in the big theaters and arenas and stuff, they're like, got their own energy as well. So I guess that's one thing we're excited about this Australian tour is like, we're back, those pubs, they're like, I mean, some of them are pretty big. Some of them.
It's where we began.
But it's where we began. And we can, it all came off the back of a cancelled festival tour and we scrambled to get like Friday, Saturday nights because we're a Friday, Saturday night band.
Absolutely.
We're not a midweek band.
Yeah, we got kids now.
Yeah.
It must be a pretty cool thing, like, you know, to come back all these years later and get together and you're doing your own thing musically, like both individually, and to come back and to play these songs. And not only that, like the response we get from people that are going to these shows, you know, myself included, this album was massive as a music fan. Mm. Like it was awesome. Like I know the words to every song on this album. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, it must be special to have something like that.
That's what differentiates you and Nick. He doesn't.
It's a pretty cool thing to know that you'll have that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it is cool. And as you know, like, I don't want to say like, oh, now we're a bit wiser and older now, but I wouldn't say we're like old men.
Yeah.
But you do tend to appreciate the things that you've achieved for what they are rather than, you know, you're grateful, you know, you're a bit more grateful for what has happened rather than being sort of wrapped up in your own kind of narrative. You know, you can sit back and go like, it's pretty amazing situation we're in now to be able to still be playing these songs.
Absolutely.
And enjoying it probably more than ever. And dare I say, probably playing better than ever because something comes with a bit of maturity. Like the shows just are so much better than they used to be. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's good because I'd like to go for a bit of a trip down memory lane and I'd like to start with your...
Please go to 11.
Hello, Cleveland! Hello, Cleveland!
You guys have your ultimate Spinal Tap moment.
It's not... There's no one moment. The whole... That's like a documentary, like not a mockumentary. It's actually like what actually happens on tour happens in that. There's nothing... That's not... There's nothing funny about Spinal Tap. It's just like watching us on tour, you know?
And we've gotten lost. I mean, we went to the wrong Triple M today.
Exactly. Because you moved a year and a half ago and we didn't know, you know?
All right, this is called, all right. All right, so what I have done here, lads, is I put together a little bit of a game. I've gone through your gig history and I've randomly plucked out things to see what you remember.
This is my time to shine.
I don't remember any of this.
I call myself the Markives because I have a good memory for all of the past, but this is where I'll get found out.
All right, cool. Well, I'd really like you to paint a picture and describe what it was like playing the Duke of Windsor in Melbourne alongside bands like...
That was strange. Whose drummer is now our tour manager?
Oh, really? Oh, cool. Shannon. Yeah, shout outs. Talk to me about the Melbourne music scene coming up for you guys, because I feel like once you guys exploded, Melbourne music kind of really took off, you know?
I mean, we used to love like going and watching Dallas Crane. You know, that was a thing. We were in love with the Melbourne music scene as much as the people who came and see us play, you know? Like we had our bands that we loved and we were in awe of and... You know, we would try and, you know, we'd learn from them. And they were one of those bands that they were kind of like our big brothers, you know, like, especially like Shan, like he's still working with us, you know, like he's, we would be front row watching those guys when they'd play at the Tote, even when we were like, you know,
when it started happening.
Yeah, we were still in love with like the bands we loved, you know. Duke of Windsor, I mean, that's where we met.
Yeah.
That's where I met the boys. I was playing a show with my band, The Casinos, and Nick and Chris were there having a Palmer because we were on so early, and they were like, "That like the vibe of that bass player." So, yeah. I mean, the whole history of the band, we used to have
meetings. Oh, we lived there. Like, we'd hang out there. We'd have our meetings there. We had our first manager there. Rehearsals.
I remember
auditions.
That was our headquarters. Yeah, I remember we were having conference calls. Back then, it was all conference calls around a phone, you know, with the like major labels around the world.
Yeah.
Sitting on empty kegs at the back of the Duke in the office. Like,
well, that was the story we used to hear about you guys, that you guys had this gig at the Duke of Windsor that was like there was only 20 people there, but all of them had flown in from all around the world. Is there any truth to that?
I think that's probably more accurate. That happened in Sydney.
Okay, cool.
But I remember going to Sydney and that was when, I mean, there was someone from every major label in the world at that Sydney show.
Did they wait to tell you? They wanted us to go out there and we were like, nah. Because it's like
smart.
Yeah, we were like, no, if you're interested, come out here and see us. So, I mean, it wouldn't happen now. Like, there's no way like a bunch of execs would fly around the world to Australia to see a band play. There's not a chance.
Yeah.
But you know, back then it was a different world. So, we really wanted to sign a global record deal because we'd heard stories of, you know,
actually,
people
John
signing
Watson,
to the Australian
Silver
label.
Silverchair's manager gave us some. He was very instrumental in giving. John Watson.
Yeah.
Because we heard horror stories of friends' bands who'd signed with the Australian label but the parent company didn't have any skin in the game, so they sort of didn't. You know,
kinda
I mean,
stuck.
That's a bit inside baseball, but you know, like, so we wanted to make sure that we were signed out of like one of the majors out of the country. So we signed a label, Elektra in New York, which is part of like the Atlantic Warner umbrella, but whatever, people don't care about that.
No, that's cool, man. It's good to hear. Like, music lovers will like this. This must have been fun for you guys to play. I don't know if you would have got, I'd say you would have been to this festival. First time you played Meredith.
We supported John Spencer Blues Explosion the night before, and it was us, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and John Spencer Blues Explosion at the Palace, which is now burnt
down.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
The one next to the Palais.
Yeah. Do you remember Meredith?
Yeah, I do. That's the last time I've been to Meredith, and I've been to like eight of them because I grew up down that way. I remember we were on early, and it was.
I remember Meredith.
Some band drove a car through the audience.
That was us.
That was you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Accidentally.
No. I think Warped drove a car through the audience.
Oh, well, maybe one band does it every year.
There's no way you'd be allowed to do that now, like 20 years later, drive a car through an audience.
We did it accidentally because we took the wrong turn.
I remember it was extremely hot and we had a Winnebago, and that was all. We got picked up from the gig at the Palace after the gig with John Spencer and the Yeah Yeahs in a Winnebago and drove down to Meredith and woke up down there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because we were
on first on the Saturday.
Oh,
yeah, we were one of the first on. Yeah,
okay.
It was early days.
Did you hang for the weekend or did you come back
I did, definitely.
I did, yeah. I was just going to say, my main memory from that was, again, talking about Dallas Crane and Shannon, because Shannon's girlfriend at the time participated in the Meredith Gift.
Oh, that's right.
Explain what the Meredith Gift is.
The Meredith Gift is a nude race that they have every year right at the end of the festival.
Do they still do that?
I think they do.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they do. The Meredith Gift, and it's...
And then Shannon just going, no one look.
We're going to do it. I always want to know what this is like. I'm just going to play a little snippet from the intro.
Our next guests are a wonderful rock and roll band from Australia. And this is their debut CD, and it's gone platinum. This CD has gone platinum. So be careful when you... When you put it in your CD player, it could screw it up.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Get Born. Please welcome Jet.
Those things are funny because, like, they're literally on every day. They've got another band. They've got other guests. And you're kind of... You're there. Like, you're part of the show, but it's almost like everything is just so...
Yeah.
Like, you just... You know, you get a short sound check. The band, the funny thing is, it's always the house band that really loves, appreciates you and talks to you. You know, Paul Schaefer and the rest of them. Like, I remember they were like, they're always into it, especially like a young kind of band like us who were like kicking ass at the time. They were into that. But those days are really quite odd. They're not like an enjoyable experience because you kind of get your sound check and then they strike the stage. They take everything off and then they set it all up in the ad break before. So things are just kind of like quickly done. And then you're just on live television straight away and then you play it and then it's done. And you've got nowhere to put your sort of adrenaline.
Yeah, like exactly.
And then
true.
You're like, yeah. Oh.
And there's obviously for the American label guys, there's a real palpable nervous energy because they know that for them it's make or break. And if you do a good performance, it can really accelerate things. Yeah. Or if you, yeah. you know, if you
I remember
get it wrong, it can be the end of your career.
I remember when we did SNL, which is, I think, 2003 Christmas one. They had a big Christmas special and it had Elijah Wood when the Lord of the Rings stuff had just come out.
Oh,
so it was
that's
like
a big
episode. It was like, you know, 20 million people watching.
Because Elijah Wood hosted it.
Yeah. And we were like, you know, we know SNL. We have, you know, we it's in the zeitgeist, but it's not like something in Australia that's like a big thing.
It doesn't have the cultural importance. Yeah,
and so we'd gone out the night before, and they thought we were going to screw it up, and you know, they were so stressed that we were going to screw it up. I think they sent someone out with us because we're in New York, you know, like
having the time of life. Yeah.
And they were so stressed we were going to screw it up. But I remember that being actually one of the more enjoyable ones because it sounded great. The stage sounded great. And because that one you're set up and you play a couple of times during the show, or two or three times you play a song.
Yeah.
So, and it was the last one. So I remember we did it and then that we all went out for party with the crew. Yeah, with all the cast and stuff. And it was, I remember that was still like Maya Randolph and that kind of era.
Oh, cool.
So I remember going out and Jimmy Fallon was on the show as well. You know,
hadn't done his own thing yet.
No, he was still on the show, yeah.
Well, it must have gone really well because then you went and won the MTV award in Miami alongside the likes of, who else was there?
Hey girl problems, I feel bad for you, son.
Right.
I got 99 problems.
They sat behind us. You know an interesting story
really?
About this? Yeah, they were just behind, or we were probably behind them, to be fair. We played as well, and it was the first time we ever got one of those ridiculous American award ceremony gift bags, which I've probably got nothing left in.
What's in them?
I don't know. There was a day where we just got taken to a thing where you could just choose some free stuff like sunglasses or whatever, you know.
Right.
But I don't have any of it left because it's all kind of disposable stuff, really.
Yeah,
you know, interesting thing about this, and I'd like to get it out there because I want it back. Someone has my MTV Music Award, the Moon Man, in Melbourne, and I don't know who it is because mine went missing and someone's got it. And I really want it back.
Where do you reckon you left it?
Well, I went to Nick's uncle's.
Uh-oh.
He's looking at me. Uh-oh. He's looking at me.
And I've asked his uncle, Adrian. I was like, have you got it? And he claims no. He doesn't know where it is. So, yeah. And every time I go to Cam or Nick's house and I see one, I actually seriously want it back. Like, it's a part of, like, my music history that I don't have now because it's got misplaced. And someone's got it. Someone knows where it is.
All right, we'll put the word out here.
I don't know where it is.
We'll put a word out around Melbourne.
Yeah,
we'll go to Dingley and we'll
I want it back. If it comes back, I'll offer a reward.
What was the after party like on that?
What reward would you offer?
Yeah, actually,
I'll offer it once they give it back.
Because I might know where it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. After party, we got invited to Usher's after party.
Oh, my God.
And he had tigers in cages. And he was in a throne. And he was really nice.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember this?
No.
Yeah, because we won it. And I think it was probably the first time people, in different sort of genres of music, really kind of put two and together. Like, oh, that song, those guys, you know, like, because, you know, music was so disparate then. It was, you know, the different worlds and stuff. But I remember, like, as soon as we won the award, we were like, all the invites were flying our way to all the after parties. But yeah, we ended up going to Usher's party. I don't know why, but it was.
What's Usher like? Did you meet him?
Yeah, I think he was nice, you know, like.
Seems
he was just
missing.
In it. I remember he had a bit of a throne and he had like a bejeweled cut.
A bit of a throne.
But I think he had like wild cats in cages at his party from memory, which is probably a little bit
distorted.
PC now, yeah.
Was anyone else there? Because Beyonce was at that, Outkast was at that, J-Lo was also at that one.
Wow, we were just too busy with Usher.
I think did we go to a few? Because
we probably did.
I remember moving around quite a bit.
I remember Jimmy Fallon was hanging out with us as well.
That's right.
Because we just played the thing not long before.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
Holy hell. That's great. Well, then you guys came home. I was at this Big Day Out. It was so much fun. And it was probably the best Big Day Out lineup of all time. Nothing else
matters. Oh, yeah.
Metallica.
Strokes. Yeah.
Just to name a few, we got the Strokes, the Darkness.
I didn't remember them being on it.
I wonder if you guys got on stage with the Flaming Lips.
Yeah, you did.
I did. Me and Fab from the Strokes were dressed up together.
Cool. Who else is on that? Kings of Leon?
Yep.
Talk to me about
Danny
that,
Warhols.
Man.
Danny Warhols were on that
Danny's
one as well.
Danny's on that too.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was the exact moment. That would have been like a pretty triumphant return because that would have been January. Album was released in September.
We won the Hottest 100 that year on the just the day before the Melbourne show, I believe, or the day or two before. So that was huge. I mean, we were on the... I think it was called, I can't remember the name.
Green stage, or red, or whatever,
but it wasn't the main stage. I think it was one of those things where we got offered an earlier slot on the main stage or a later slot on the smaller stage, and we chose the small stage and just packed it out.
Yeah.
It was great, you know, and it was kind of, all those bands were, like, the Strokes had taken off, but us and the Kings of Leon, we toured the States together. There was a lot of bands in there that we either loved growing up or met on the way, and it was everyone at once. It was, you know, it was a pretty huge ego fest because, you know, everyone's the same age. Everyone's trying to prove
themselves.
But also
just the nature of that festival was also great because the distances were so vast. You'd end up having a lot of downtime hanging out with other bands.
Yeah.
And so I think it kind of, you know, there is always a lot of ego around bands, but that tour kind of knocked it out of everyone after a while, you know.
Well, like a celebration of everyone.
Yeah, totally. And you spend like two weeks with each other than you don't, you know. And you're spending 2 weeks with each other, and you're also, all the flights were chartered. So every band was on the same flight.
Yeah, yeah. Same hotel, same flight.
So it ends up, if there was some sort of like angst between any bands, it was over by show two because you were just always together and you're just doing the same thing, you know, ultimately.
Hell yeah. And it just would have been so much fun to play those songs and like really satisfying as well. I imagine when you guys did your 3 sold out nights at the Forum. As well, like that would have been a real just kind of buzz. Like,
yeah, especially doing it in Melbourne, just up the street from where we're all sort of hung out.
Then you went to the States and you played some shows with these guys.
I was thinking about them before when you're doing your intro because, you know, I appreciate what you said about, you know, bands like us sort of opening the doors for bands like you. But I mean, for us, the Vines really opened the door for us, you know. And we always felt a real kinship with them because they did come before us and they did kind of bring the eye of the world to Australia. And then we shared management. We went to the States. We hung out with them over there and always felt a big kinship with them for that reason.
What was the tour like with the Living End as well, you guys?
Yeah, again, we didn't know them beforehand and we're still dear friends with them now,
I remember seeing, Chris Cheney when I was in high school, and I remember going to Southland Shopping Centre and just seeing Chris walking through through Southland Shopping Centre. I remember thinking, what the hell is he doing here?
You don't think, you know, see them out there,
a shop for underpants just like you.
By the way, I was at Southland yesterday for the record.
I was there last week.
And you know what? It was great for us because we were playing great then and also, we had like because it was the US and the Living End kind of they toured there a bit, but they weren't as big, so they were on before us.
Yeah,
and if you're going to go on after the Living End,
yeah, that's tough.
You're going to have to make sure you do a great job because they are one of the hardest bands to follow.
Yeah,
and it was definitely they would turn it up every night. It would get better and better and better and better. And anyone who's seen them knows that they're just perfect. Their showmanship is ridiculous. Yeah. So it would actually, you know, it would make us try harder, you know, make sure our show's great, you know.
Yeah.
And then the Vines they'd been around a bit longer, so they headlined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are the Vines? It must have been a pinch yourself moment as well, like seeing Craig and all the gang.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you know, it's, you know, Craig's an interesting guy. So there was.
Some days would be ridiculously amazing, and some days would just be like, holy shit.
Yeah. How are the crowds? Were they mostly Australians or
no?
It's never been a thing we've sort of had is Australian crowds outside of
Australia.
There's
always an Australian contingent, sure, but I mean, it was mostly,
It was great. It was like good. There was big theatres and, buses and all that kind of stuff. And everywhere you went, there was someone who understood your sense of humour because there was three bands on the road and they were all Australian. Yeah. And we all sort of, you know, we all got each other.
But it was I remember thinking it was great to feel like you're sort of part of this Australian gang in the States,
kind
of us against the world vibe was good.
There's another tour I want to ask you about. I'm not sure if it's true because sometimes these aren't too accurate, but did you play with?
Yeah, we did.
Oasis and these guys?
Yeah, we did a tour. We did a US tour with Oasis and Kasabian, and it was like Madison Square Garden, like, you know, Red Rocks, all those big ones. It was great, and you know,
Hollywood Bowl,
Hollywood Bowl, and it was, you know, It was one of those ones where I was never a massive Oasis fan growing up, but after that tour, I was like, I get it now.
Yeah, you know,
seeing them every night, and it was fun, you know. Being on tour with, like, not only Liam and Noel, like, I really got along well with Noel. Liam's, at the time, was pretty, like, it's still very, very, very old school Liam at the time.
Weirdly, Noel became Chris's mate, and I'm still in touch with Liam to this day.
Yeah.
How cool.
But it doesn't make, really, when you know our personalities, it doesn't make any sense, really.
But yeah, it was great. And, you know, and the guys in their band were fantastic as well. And they treated like any two. And also we became really good mates with the Kasabian guys who they were like heaps bigger than us at the time in the UK, but no one really knew them in the States yet. So they were on first. Right. And again, it's one of those things where you're following one of those bands that you're just like, wow, they're a really great live band, you know, those guys. And we're still friends with those guys too.
Yeah.
After all these years.
I know, you know what it's like, you know, you go on long tours and you form some pretty strong bonds along the way, and those friendships still stand up today.
That's awesome, man. And it must have been cool, like, you were living overseas for a little bit. It must have been cool for bands to come through and pop in, and you could go to their shows and hang
out. Absolutely. You know, absolutely. And it's always fun. I always feel more Australian when I'm not in Australia, you know what I mean? Yeah. I sort of feel like it's not really, our ambassador's a bit too strong, but you know, it's nice to, you know, whenever there's an Australian band that comes through whatever city you're in, and make a point of going and hanging out, and I think it's those things
around,
are important.
Yeah, cool. All right, there's one more that I've got to ask you about because I watched you guys play with the man.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about performers. What was it like watching The Boss every night?
It was great. Yeah. I got a Simon.
Boring. I'm just joking.
When's he going to wrap this up?
Yeah, come on. 3 hours, Bruce. Yeah. Jeez. That actually was the tour that kind of brought us all back together to play again.
Nice.
Yeah, it was 2017 and we got the call from Gudinski. You know, two people you don't say no to is Michael Gudinski and Bruce Springsteen.
Or the Boss.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other Boss.
The other boss. Yeah, there's two bosses in the world at the time. But that was fantastic. Getting to see that level of just effort and, you know, like, you've never seen a three-hour show that's felt like a one-hour show, you know. And they would just how seriously they took everything, not in a boring way, but just like they would go and they'd play songs that they'd never played before, and they'd, you know, or Bruce would just call out a song that they hadn't played in 15 years. And backstage one day I saw his guitar, like, you know, he's got it like 25, 30 Fender Telecasters lined up. And, you know, I asked his tech, why has he got so many guitars? And he's like, well, they're all in different tunings. And if he calls out a song, I need to know where that guitar in that particular tuning is so I can give it to him because I don't have time to tune one up.
Yeah.
So they had to have, because he'll just call a song and the band has to know it.
That just reminded me, if you remember on the Oasis tour when it was Hurricane Katrina happened.
Oh, that's right.
And one of the guys who's driving the back line had family in New Orleans and just made a dash for it back home to check on his family with the entire backline.
Oh, really?
On a massive semi trailer.
The tour that we were, I think we may have been in, like, we were in somewhere in Texas, Houston or something, and we're all in the same hotel, and the show got cancelled. The next show, which would have been, I think it was like down in somewhere in New Orleans,
right?
Near New Orleans. Somewhere around there. Anyway, so we just stayed in this hotel for like a week because a bunch of the shows got cancelled. And geez, that was pretty. And we were, it was pretty debaucherous week. Just three bands staying in one little, and it was like one little boutique hotel booked out by the whole lot of us. Yeah. And we weren't meant to be there for that long, but it was like I was talking about misplaced energy before.
Oh,
when you're meant to be doing shows and you're not, like, it's something about it where you're just a bit like...
Yeah, totally. You don't know what to do. It must have been a pretty special thing for, you know, you guys hadn't played in a while and to know that, you know, Bruce wants you to play with him in Australia to get back together and play gigs. Like,
yeah.
That's so cool.
It was great. And, you know, it's like it's kicked off with 3 days in three shows at Amy Park down here.
Yeah.
And all around the country up to, and you know what else? We sort of got on like one of the best stage managers in the country called Dougal McAndrew. And Dougs works for us from time to time still.
Yes, mate.
And because we were thinking, oh, these big American acts, they can be such assholes, you know, their crew and stuff. Like, we're really prepared for like to be treated poorly or, you know, just like, you know, whatever. But they were so nice to us there. Yeah. We were contracted to play for 40 minutes. which is not very long, really.
Oh, yeah, that's the hits.
And then by the second show, their stage manager came up to us and was like, "You guys interested in doing an hour? We'd love to hear more." Which is, this never happens. They want you to play less, if anything. So it was like that. And then I remember there was a show that got kind of delayed because of a thunderstorm up in the Hunter Valley.
Yeah.
And this is another thing, like, they'd normally just cut the support band and say, "Sorry, guys, you know," because they had to push the show back hours. They normally would just cut it, and they're like, "Nah, we want you to play. We really want to see you guys play." So because again, like, you're just like, "Oh, this is not going to happen. This sucks." You know, because you want to play. It doesn't matter, you know.
Yeah,
like, that's what you're there for. And then, you know, even though the show got severely delayed, they still wanted us to go out there and play the set and
stuff
like that. So, you know, they were really lovely to us. You know, it's great.
How good a festival and support sets.
Going out there,
40 minutes an hour, play the hits and get off. Oh, it's so
the greatest thing with that Springsteen tour, though, is was definitely going out for dinner with, because Steve Van Sant's been a champion of the band since day one. Like, he would come and see us play at like the Mercury Lounge in New York, whatever, because there's like a 300 cap room.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's at the height of Sopranos.
You guys got played in Sopranos?
Yeah,
I'm pretty
that's
sure.
True.
I remember. I remember that. I was just like watching that. I was like, "Holy hell, this is the coolest."
Yeah, they
thing
played "Take It or Leave It" in the Butter Bing.
Yeah.
But we went out for dinner with Steve because we knew him a bit more now. We went out for dinner with him a couple of times on that tour, and he'd slowly coax out a bit of some Silvio Dante out of him, and he would just do it at dinner. He'd just be sitting there doing Silvio. It was
that is the coolest thing ever.
So
man.
Good.
So what's happening for the rest of this kind of year? Like, much planned apart from this tour?
Yeah, well, this tour we've got coming up quite soon. And then we've got a UK tour, which is, I don't think, announced yet, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then we're just locking the rest of the tour. We're playing Gather Round on the 7th of April.
That'll be fun.
And some other bits and pieces like that.
Grand Prix next weekend.
Yeah, talk to me about that. What's it like kind of coming back home and playing a...
Those things thing like are fun because the production's off its head.
Yeah.
And it's like an hour festival set. There's also perks. Like, you get to go.
Yeah.
You know, you get well looked after, and it's
whenever I'm here, me and Mark usually get together anyway, times, so this will be nice excuse.
This time we just don't have to wrangle tickets. We can just we've got our own accreditation this time. So
it's cool to come home to and play like a big festival like that.
Totally,
as well,
yeah.
You know, it's pretty special.
Yeah, those things are fun, and like I said, like, it's not a lot of pressure.
Yeah,
because we just get up and play, like, you know, the great set where you've just put all your most fun songs in, you know, like, it's not a time to get esoteric. It's a time to just be a party band, really.
Yeah, and everyone will be pretty loose by the time we get on stage. It'll be fun.
But, you know, I look forward to rehearsing just as much as gigs these days, because I just love getting in a room with these guys and, you know, spending time, getting it, you know, and just like the laughs. And, you know, half the stuff with being in a band is the hang, you know, rather than the actual playing. So it's good.
Yeah, and it's exciting for us as fans. Like, you guys are in the bubble, so, you know, you guys to see yourself as four mates, but you're one of the biggest Australian bands of all time, and it's super exciting that you're back playing shows. And,
oh, thank you, man.
And it must be really cool to kind of do it and have all your other things going on the side as
it
well.
Is. It's a different stage of our lives, and I think we're a lot more sort of secure in ourselves than we obviously ever have been. We've got kids now, and it's not, you know, life's not about us or this band, which takes the pressure off it, you know, and it keeps it kind of light and fun And you know, and things have been going well. Like, we weren't really expecting to be here doing things like this with people like you today, you know, and then all of a sudden to be honest, I don't know, we didn't really speak about this, but it is reminiscent of 20 years ago when, you know, we were just hanging out as friends doing music for the pure love of music again. And it kind of feels like this, you know. We've been working on new material. We've got some new stuff coming out, hopefully quite soon.
Yeah,
some shows in Europe and in America. Sick. So it's a nice. It feels like a, you know, it's a nice moment.
Yeah, and you know, playing these songs and people singing back all the words, like, what a cool feeling, and doing that around the world too.
Yeah, like I said before, it's about being grateful as well for what you've done in the past and how lucky you are to be doing it now, still, you know, and with your friends. And that's something you learn as you get a bit wiser, I guess.
Yeah. All right, one more game. This is what we do with every band that comes in.
On Triple M's Homegrown with Matty-O, it's time for...
Uh-oh, it's my party again.
The lovely Jules on the vocals out there. Nick, her family's from Pescara, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Thumbs up. So what this is, so I'm going to give you three acts. You've either got to write a song with one, party with the next, and the third you take home to dinner.
Okay.
All right? Okay.
Is this, so, is this a collaborative between Nick and I?
You can go separately too. Or,
we'll
you
see
know,
how we go.
Yeah, we'll see how we go. So the three acts you get to choose from, right, party or dinner. We got... Did you ever, never want to let somebody down? You Am I, the second... AC/DC in the third.
Okay, right with the Beatles.
Right with the Beatles.
Right with
yeah.
the Beatles. Okay.
Dinner with you and Mike, because they're friends of ours.
Yeah.
And
I guess you party with the AC/DC. We were not really.
They don't really, they don't really.
Go have a cup of tea with Angus. You know? A glass of milk.
Man, you got asked to potentially fill in for some shows
or sing
AC/DC.
I auditioned for.
For Axl Rose's job, or before?
Well, yeah, he pipped me at the gate. Yeah.
It came down to Nick and Axl.
Yeah. That was wild, right? I remember calling you about it at the time because you were playing, you were filling
I was
playing, in.
I was filling in for Brian Adams.
Yeah. What the hell was going on?
It was another Gadinski favor. He called me up and was like, "Mark, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to go on tour with Brian Adams. His bass player's just quit." And I was like, again, you don't say no, because one day you'll be in prison in Czech Republic and you'll get one phone call and Michael's the guy you would want to call.
When someone's misplaced your passport.
Yeah, exactly. So at the same time, Nick was in Atlanta in a rehearsal studio with
I spent 2 days
ACDC.
As the singer, officially. Unofficially.
You'd be a perfect fit for that. How did it kind of happen from start to finish?
I've been living overseas for a long time, and I came back to visit my family, and I was staying with my in-laws, and I got up in the morning and read the paper, and it was saying that the singer was not in the band anymore,
yeah.
Brian Johnson. And I remember saying to my father-in-law, I was like, holy shit, like you would not want to step into those shoes. And literally 20 minutes later, the phone rang. They're saying, would you be interested in going to Atlanta, Georgia to audition to potentially fill in for this next run of dates they've got? And I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
I thought, you know... I think I'll say yes just for the life experience. I wasn't really expecting to get the gig, to be honest with you, but I just thought, how could I turn this opportunity down?
Was that before or after you'd done Back in Black with Muse?
After.
Yeah, because I feel like that may have...
And it was, and they did come up and they said that they'd seen that. It was like, you know... and I called Matt and I said, hey, thanks for that, by the way.
What was it like when you got there? Was it just the big kind of rehearsal?
It was pretty weird because they just stopped where the tour had stopped, and it happened to be Atlanta, Georgia, and they were in, it was actually the Black Keys rehearsal studio. Black Crowes, and it was a tiny place, but they were set up there with their enormous backline. And I remember watching AC/DC thinking, there's no way all of those amps are on. Let me tell you, they were all fucking on.
Whoa.
And it was the loudest thing I'd ever heard in my entire life.
Oh my God, man.
And he put me through my paces, and I realized now that
he's... Who was driving it? Who was running?
Angus.
Angus was. Angus. Yeah.
And he was like, everything was a test to see how I would, handle it, like the volume. And he was just going, all right, let's do this song. And I didn't know, I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So he'd just go over there and learn it. And that whole band waiting there for 10 minutes. I'm just going, oh, fuck.
That is daunting. That is so scary.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. But
there's not many people in this world who've got to sing with AC/DC, though. So there's only probably four people.
It was great. And they were lovely, it was pretty intense. And I just landed in Australia, so I was already jet lagged. Then I've flown to Atlanta the day after. And there was one day where I didn't even sleep for 48 hours. But again, I realize now it was, he's a super professional guy, and he wanted to push me to my absolute limit to see how I would react, I think.
I feel like the Bond stuff would be absolutely in your
wheelhouse. Well, he asked me, they said, what do you want to do? And I smashed out a couple of Bonds.
Because, Brian stuff's a different voice to you.
Yeah, it's like, really
Bond
hard,
stuff
actually.
Is like in your total wheelhouse. But
and I've since found out, because I was like, how? Because I remember trying to practice some of that stuff, going, how is he doing this? Because it's a very unusual way of singing.
Yeah.
And then someone told me, he goes, because you're making the mistake of thinking he's pushing out enormous amount of volume, which is how I sing, but he's not. He's whispering, but with like directly into a microphone with this enormous volume behind him. So it sounds like the loudest thing in the world, but it's not at all. He's barely pushing out.
Because you couldn't do that. Brian Johnson couldn't sing like that every night of the week anyway. You'd have to figure out a technique where you're not.
So is that how Axl does it, do you reckon?
I mean, I didn't see that, and I didn't know, because it was all very,
it was all NDAs and stuff.
Someone made the mistake of some tour manager accidentally, because there was all the, some of them were there we were like Axel was there at the same time, and someone accidentally left his name on a.
Who else was trying out? Do you know?
There was a couple of guys like there was some guys from AC/DC cover bands, like the best cover bands in the world.
That makes sense. Yeah. Jeez, what a moment it would have been for them. Holy shit.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's good you got
wild,
to do it. I'm glad
wild
you got to
2 days.
Do it. That's so funny. You're doing AC/DC, you're doing Bryan Adams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can tell you which one is cooler.
Hey, lads, thanks so much for back and having a chat, man. It's so great to touch base with you again. I'm so glad that we get to hear these songs live. You're going out regionally and excited for what's coming up. Pleasure to touch base
Thank
as always.
Thank you so much for having us.